Hello and welcome to the very first episode of Why Shakespeare, a podcast that asks people why they like, or as a matter of fact, do not like Shakespeare, why it might be important to them, why they do it, study it, play it, or shun it, and why it is still relevant today. My name is Victoria and I am your host. I'm a writer and a director born in Ukraine, raised in Switzerland, and I moved to the UK because of my passion for Shakespeare. People always ask me, but why? Why Shakespeare? So I thought I would return the favour. My first guest is the actor Bob Barrett. You might know him from Holby City, but Bob is also a seasoned Shakespearean actor, notably with the company Propeller. He also appears in the movie Shakespeare in Love as George Bryan. I interviewed him in Theatre Royal Plymouth as we were touring together on Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None. So this is the first episode, and it is a long one. And Bob and I are not professionals at this, and we talk over each other because we're great friends and we get super excited, and we're both empaths. But I really think the conversation is wonderful and a testimony to what I want to do with this podcast, which is making you feel like you were in the room with us when we were talking about Shakespeare with a coffee or a glass of wine, in this case, a coffee. This also was in a dressing room, so phones go off and people are in the corridors and there are theatre sounds interfering with it all. It was recorded on my very first recorder, so I must apologise for the quality of the sound. I promise it gets better after this one. But having said all that, it is a very special conversation with a very special artist and a great friend, and I hope you enjoy listening to it. This episode contains a lot of swearing. Enjoy. Here we are in Bob Barrett's dressing room at Theatre Royal Plymouth a grey March morning in the year of our Lord 2024. We're here to launch Shakespeare.
Honoured. I'm honoured to be launching. This is incredible.
This feels very right because the first time I articulated the idea was when I stumbled upon you by chance.
Yes.
In a cafe in York.
Yes, that's right. In York. It was in York, wasn't it? You told me.
Something was starting to form and you walked in this cafe and we had a lovely brunch.
It was right next to the theatre.
Yeah.
I remember that like yesterday.
I remember telling you and going, if Bob Barrett thinks it's a good idea,
maybe we should do it. Amazing idea.
I think it's important because everyone always asks me, why Shakespeare? Why did you first like it? What first drew you to Shakespeare?
That's a great question. The first time I was drawn to him, I was taught at school. I went to a private school. We studied him, like you do at school. I hadn't done Shakespeare before, but I'd done a lot of drama before. But I remember reading Summer Night's Dream, and it's a play I've done now three times. We were reading it in class, and I was making everyone laugh. The teacher said, well, why doesn't Bob just read it? Just read it all. And everyone was like, yeah, that's a great idea. Partly because they didn't want to read it, but also because I was making them laugh. So I was allowed to read huge swathes of the text. It was instant. It's like falling in love. I just thought, this is something incredibly special. So I always was drawn to Shakespeare, always. And I remember doing Oxbridge. I nearly got in. I did no work. I nearly got in. But the essay about King Lear, and I'd written an essay. What was the question? Why does Cordelia die?
Ooh.
And I'd written this huge big essay and they liked it. They thought it was great. So that nearly got me in. But I didn't, because I didn't work hard. They quite rightly said you wouldn't work hard enough. It wasn't my path. I also thought, yes, I want to read. I loved reading Shakespeare, Our Contemporary by Ian Cotton, all these amazing books about Shakespeare, all of which I've still got. But I thought, study him, I want to play him. I want to do it. I said to my sister, please get me an audition at drama school. Please. And she said, okay. She got back to me and said, I can only get an audition for one drama school. And it's the Guildhall. And I said, is that the one next to the Barbican that's linked to the RSC? And she said, yes. So I said, that's great. So I went And luckily I got in. And I went in
first go,
one drama school. I didn't go for any other drama school. So stupid.
Doing the polar opposite to what we
everyone
recommend.
Does go for every single drama school. I went to one drama school. I thought, I'm not going to get in. And I got in. Oh. It was at the RSC, and we had Patsy Rodenberg, Sue Lefton, people who'd worked at the RSC, who were working at the RSC as well. So I thought, well, at least we've got that. At least they know what they're talking about.
This is very topical now.
Yes.
Topical subject.
About Patsy.
I don't want to generate a debate here about Patsy. I think it's more, why do you think her approach, or what was it about her approach? What is still in your toolbox from her?
I loved her very much. I thought she was great. She's a voice teacher, not a director of Shakespeare. She's very good. I just adored her. And I thought she was the only one there who had a sort of understanding of it and a handle on it. So I think you go through your life, I think you look for people who are going to help unlock the secrets to how we approach it. You have your own idea about what it should be, which I'll go into, I'm sure I'll go into, but you need, and the first person who I felt that about was Patsy. She had the right level of passion about it. She was unbelievably passionate about Shakespeare. And spoke with authority. I thought, okay, that's good. There used to be a thing called the William Pole Festival. If you got to the last year of drama school, every drama school would send two people to do a duologue on the Olivier stage, and it would get judged by whoever in the day.
They now have the Sam on a Maker Festival.
This was the precursor to that. Mm. I remember she chose me, and Rhys Ifans, big film star, she said, I want you both to do The Winter's Tale. I did Leontes, the scene between Leontes and Camillo, and I played Camillo since, but I was Leontes in this, and it's the scene, inch thick, knee deep, head and knee, it's a short one. And a forked one. We were obsessed about it. I remember going there, and actually, weirdly, the man who's influenced me more than anything about Shakespeare, Ed Hall, was actually acting in the Mount View one.
Oh, wow.
during that. Judi Dench had just directed the Scottish play at Central. So Saskia Wickham and someone else were doing the duologue from there. So she was there. And we were all like, well, they're going to win because, you know, it's Judi Dench. And she was very sweet and very lovely. And then when we did it, we were sat next to each other. Bamber Gascoigne, who used to do a university challenge, was very sort of intellectual, came out to judge. He said, I don't like saying, you know, it's not about best and worst, but the duologue that was far and away the best of the day was Guildhall with the Winter's Tale. And I had my knees. And I remember coming out, and everyone was there from the college, and they all came out, and they said it was amazing. But I remember thinking, that's great. And I know I have a facility because I love doing it, but I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know, I just did it. We'd done a monologue. Tony Church, who used to run the Guildhall, was a massive actor at the RSC, and Peter Hall, the National. We all did a monologue. Rhys wasn't there. He was going to do Rhys III, but he wasn't there. He singled out two of us. He singled out Geraldine Somerville, who went on to do Cracker. And he singled out me, and I was doing Romeo. He said the difference was we got inside the text and worked from the inside out, whereas everyone else was working from the outside in.
Ah.
I had no idea what that meant. I just went for it. And I was like, but I didn't understand what that meant. I was going, you're faced with Everest, and you're going, I don't know what to do. Then I went on professionally.
But do you think it's something to do with the fact that you weren't afraid of it?
Yes.
Because it's that thing,
wasn't scared of it.
Where people are scared of Shakespeare and go, oh, it's Everest and I don't know how to face it, so let me plaster a bunch of stuff on top.
Yes.
To kind of pretend that, you know, I've got this.
That's so true.
As opposed to going, no, this is Everest. So
I want to climb, I'm up for it. I think I always felt, yes, I can do this. And also, it's not just about, oh, I can do this. It's about, I want to do this. There's something about, and I'd read about it. I remember reading Bill Gaskell, A Sense of Direction, and about him talking about Edith Evans when Colin Blakely, my hero, was doing Richard III, and she was playing Margaret. He had a thick Irish accent. He was going, false boarding woman. He was going, no, call it false boding woman. Love the words. And I thought, well, I do love the words. The words are everything to me. I was desperate to do it. And I think you're right. I think it's having no fear. I had no fear of the words because I knew whatever I felt, everything was about the words. Because when you looked at the script, that was it. I think I always had an instinct about that. I just couldn't express it. Now, from what I've done, what I've read, people I've talked to, I can, and you'll never express it completely, but now I know everything I've followed, all the paths I've followed about writers and directors and all these things have clarified exactly how I felt before. I remember someone talking about Michael Bryant, who was a great actor and was he worked at the National for, God, 30 years, and he was doing Shakespeare. He was always the best thing. Whenever you went to see a play at the National, he was always the best thing in it. I remember going to see Lear with Anthony Hopkins, and he was great, but he played Gloucester, and he was best thing in it by miles, but, you know, because he was brilliant, Michael Bryant. And he told, I'd done a play, Hamlet, with Adrian Scarborough, and he said, Michael Bryant said three things, play to the full stop. If there's no full stop, go up at the end of the line. And everything you need is in the script.
That's it. That's all there is to it.
But then, of course, the thing about this is that you need to come up with something that helps everyone. That's fine for an actor who knows what they're doing. Yeah. But if you said that to a kid or a young actor, you need to flesh that out slightly. But that's basically all you do need. That's all you need. So I remember thinking, that's right. So I then went and did quite a bit of Shakespeare. I'd done The Dream twice before I came to the moment where the doors crashed open. Everything became more real for me, which I'll get to. I'd done Hamlet with Nina Gower, done Two Dreams. I'd done a fair bit of Shakespeare.
I've got Winter's Tale, Taming of the Shrew, Merchant of Venice.
No, this is where we go. So I'd done lots of Shakespeare and it was great. But I did these and they always went well. Everyone was going, oh my God, it's great. But again, I was going, okay, there's still not... I know there's something else that I need, that I want. I want to immerse my... It was like I was... I can't swim, but it was like I was swimming. I can swim, but I wanted to deep dive to the bottom of the ocean and then go... Now I know, and now I can immerse myself and start the journey for real. Not just dip my toe into it, but start the journey for real, where your obsession with it and your passion for it becomes visceral and real.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you used the Everest metaphor and a deep dive metaphor. But it leads me to asking, why do you think it's such extremes? Why do you think Shakespeare generates such big things and big emotions and big challenges?
Because he's everything. I think the question you were going to ask, you said you were going to ask this, is why we still do him.
Yeah.
It's the debate about where we are now with him. When you read Shakespeare, unlike anyone else, I think when you start asking the question, what was Shakespeare's state of mind when he wrote this, you're immediately asking about his state. Even if you can't glean any state of mind when he wrote this, you're still asking the question, what is his state of mind? And that misses the point, because unlike any other writer in history, there's no agenda. Mm. You don't know what he thinks about and really feels about anything. Mm. He deals with every subject with complete equanimity. He hasn't got a grievance. There's no grudge to bear. He's not settling any scores. He's not saying, this is what I feel about it. Nothing ever leaps out at you in his scripts, in his plays, that's about something that he wants to let the reader know about, because this is what he feels about this. There's none of that. Even with the great poets that came since, like John Donne and John Milton, you can glean what they felt about the world. Keats is the only one who comes close to it, but even then... And also the similarity between Keats and Shakespeare is that they have, again, and this is incredibly rare for a male writer, an equal, they use their feminine side and their masculine side equally. Yeah. And that's unbelievably rare. There's no, You don't ever feel. And I think that, so therefore, the result is his poetry flows incredibly freely. He was able to express himself completely in his writing. There's no jarring. Nothing that makes you go, what's he saying? It's just, there is no gap between his genius and what comes out on the page. And I think that's why he's lasted for so long.
Do you think there's something to do with the rhetoric there? You know, you're saying that he's not holding a grudge. Is there something to do with the fact that he always somehow pitches, you know, two people who believe they're right, right? That's conflict for you. It's two people who are both right, but who want different things.
Yes, 100%.
It's Shakespeare's legacy and rhetoric and, you know, being used to, through his education, being made to argue both sides of something, being made to stand in front of the Roman people.
Yes.
And argue this,
and
you know, and write this beautiful speech, and you think, oh my God, that's great, that's it, and then bam! And then you've got Mark Antony, and you go, oh, wait a minute.
So there's no...
We're going to change our mind now.
We're going to change our mind, and that's the thing. Because he's not behind it going, this is what I'm telling the audience, this is what I want the audience to feel. That's regardless. He goes, I'm going to present something which is complete. You make your own mind up. And that's the truth of it. That's why when people go on about Othello and they go, oh, it's Iago's play, it's nonsense. What he's doing is saying, in order for this to work, I have to be as much in Othello's mind as I am in Iago's mind. I'm not saying that good should triumph over evil. I'm not saying evil should triumph over good. I am just presenting something that's complete and free and total.
Human, and because it's flawed.
And there's nobody in the world who understands the human condition better than Shakespeare. If you genuinely understand the human condition, you never comment on it. You never say good is more important than evil, that God is more important than the devil. You're just going to say, this is what I'm presenting to you. Hold the mirror up to nature. Well said, and I agree with this about Hamlet. Hamlet was the last man of genius that he wrote, because Hamlet... He wrote, when you say he wrote a man of genius, he wrote a man who expressed philosophical and psychological ideas that people in the 20th century are still trying to work out. He was hundreds of years ahead of his time. And that man speaks those thoughts. And I think that, you know, he used, and also obviously, and this is where we get back to how you, what you do when you do it, everything you need to know about how you play Shakespeare, he wrote himself in the speech to the players. Everything you need to know about Shakespeare is in the speech to the players.
Tripping the tongue.
Tripping the tongue.
Don't you dare
don't
add anything
saw,
to it.
No, the... don't add it. Don't saw the air, but use all smoothly. You know, all that, everything. Which is why, so when Peter Hall started the RSC, he realised actors before, the great Shakespearean actors, were unbelievably gifted. The Gilcuds, the Oliviers, the Richardsons. They had an unbelievable facility. But what about when you want to do a production with an ensemble, what do you then say to the people who aren't Gielgud and Olivier? How do you say to them, this is what we do? His great book, Speech to the Players, about how you approach the script. So when I came up, this was my Road to Damascus moment, when I joined Propeller, where I did all those shows, I worked with Ed Hall, his son, and Roger Warren, who always used to sit by Peter and explain to the actors what they're saying. He was the expert on Shakespeare.
I want that job. Does that job still exist?
You're the next generation.
I want to sit down next to a director and go, this is why.
No, you should. Yeah.
Where has that job gone? Oh my God, bring it back.
But that's where I suddenly was in the ocean. Because I knew this was it. When we started Winter's Tale, we sat around the table for the first week, went through every ounce of the script, how we spoke it, and what we should do, and etc., etc. And I remember in the second week, I was watching it all, because the energy in the room was our energy, but it was also Shakespeare's energy. It was the energy of the play. And Ed stopped, he said, I just wanted to stop for a second. I just wanted to look at Bob. Bob can't believe where he is. I couldn't believe where I was. I was like, this is it. This is it. Whatever we do, we're going to get closer to it. We're going to get closer to, you know, because the thing is, when you're, because it's so complete and so free, what Shakespeare did, the strength that what you need to strive for is to get closer to his genius. If you do that, you don't let yourself get in the way of what you're saying. There is a sort of freedom and a speed to it. I've never done Shakespeare where the audience would come away and go, I've never seen Shakespeare like that. I've never seen Shakespeare that free, funny, and visceral. That's what we strive to do. Whether we succeeded completely, you never will. But I know we got closer than I've ever got before.
And is that to do with just text work? What do you think that has to do with
it? I think text work frees you up when you have a handle on how you're speaking it. So you're speaking the words, you're properly speaking the words, and you're not holding it back. You're not going, I'm going to lean on this, I'm going to lean on that. He would say, don't lean on it. Let the speech go. Let it be free. It's going to take you somewhere as an actor. You don't know where that's going to be. And therefore, you're not going, I'm going to play it like this. I'm going to stand here. And you just let it go. First thing I ever saw of them was Midsummer Night's Dream. I played bottom after. I'd never seen British Shakespeare like it because you were watching them going. And they were men. They're all men. I was going, when I watched The Lovers, I was never seen The Lovers like that before. They were in love with each other. They weren't polite. No, polite. They were bumping up against each other. They were with each other. They were kissing each other. They were fighting each other. The Lovers' Quarrel was off the scale. I've never seen a Lovers' Quarrel
like that. That's what it is in the words. Yes. In the words.
In the words.
Incredibly.
They go crazy.
They're crazy mad with jealousy, which is what he loves.
You never question they're in love. They're teenagers in love.
And that's what they do.
But I remember going, I can't wait. When I did it with him, I can't wait to see. And everyone was going, wait till you see how Ed directs it. I got to watch them because I was never a lover in the show. I was bottom. So I watched them. And they would get to a level. And you go, wow, that's amazing. And he would go, okay, guys, I want to do it one more time. He did a whole rehearsal with them. I want you to start at the level you finished and then see where we go. I have never in my life seen anything like it. They were just so... And then I saw what I saw was actors find things they'd never found before, invent things they'd never invented before, do things they never thought they could possibly do. It was Ed was just edging it, but it was Shakespeare.
The words.
The script, the words, where he goes, go there, go to that level. Go anywhere you can. And that's what my now when I watch Shakespeare. Because he sets you, it's like when you see a Hamlet and you watch the first scene. If they do the first scene, sometimes they don't even do
sometimes they start with
the not to be. You know, you're like, oh, fuck's sake. If you're going to question what he's going to do. You watch the first scene, you go, if you don't believe that the actors on stage believe there's a ghost, then you're fucked.
You're fucked.
There's no way. God, I'm going to have to sit through another fucking Hamlet where they don't believe it. And you see them going, well, nowadays, you go, not nowadays.
So do you think with Propeller, it's interesting pushing it, because obviously it's very physical work, and I found, especially when introducing it, but also working with it,
yes,
starting with the body really helps quiet those fears in the mind, quiet those, what's happening, and starting with the words and sounds, there's something about the sounds of Shakespeare that trigger an emotion in us. It's what you were talking about, getting out of your own way in your head,
exactly,
getting out of your narrative.
Exactly.
Because the sound, it's hard to explain.
It is hard to explain.
But it is that thing that the sounds provoke something in you, like great music
will
provoke an emotion, an emotional state. Your body is led to these things that you can't possibly think, that you can't sit down and go, oh, this is what I'm going to do on this line.
No.
It will never be as good. My question is, what is it about the physicality of the words? And also with Propeller, and that's interesting, is do you think because it was an all-male company, do you think something happened there?
I think... This is very interesting. I think you're absolutely right. I think when you say start with the words, people immediately get an image of academia. It's not that. It's starting the process of allowing the words to do. It does ask everything of you as an actor. Emotionally, physically, mentally, everything. But it's not that hard. Because everything is there. Everything, you're going on the greatest ride in the world. You're not going, don't be scared. Why are you scared? This is the chance of a lifetime. You know, do it, do it. I remember thinking about Propeller, I'm doing it in a way that they won't get in the way for me. That's what he said. Look at Bob, he can't believe he's in the room. You can use everything you have, but it's not you're using everything you have against the text. The text just literally puts you supercharged and sends you into an orbit, into space, because you're in a spacecraft. You know, you're up to the skies.
It's a spacecraft. Yeah,
because you're in the greatest hands ever. How lucky are we that the greatest writer who ever lived happened to be a fucking playwright? I mean, how lucky are we as actors and directors? How fucking lucky. He could have been, you know, if Tolstoy was the greatest writer, one of the great, you know, probably the second greatest writer, you know, you go, well, yes, but we have to adapt it and we have to blah, blah, blah. No, this man just wrote plays and poetry. You're allowed to touch the orb of the greatest. Exactly. Yeah, to live it, be it, and let it enhance your life. Mm. My life is better. More than I could ever imagine, because I've got to do Shakespeare. How can that not be the greatest gift you've ever got, particularly as an actor, the greatest gift? But it's interesting because for centuries, people just had the plays, and that was enough. For some reason, and it's the world we live in, people need to know who he was, what he felt, what his family's life was like. Was it him? Was it someone else? I remember someone saying, it has to be this other person because they spent a lot of time in Italy and he wrote plays about Italy. If you think that, you miss everything to do with the plays. Mm. It's not about that. It's not about Italy. You have to go to Italy to write those things. His imagination. One word we haven't used is imagination. No one had a greater imagination. There was no gap between his imagination and him and his soul.
And he didn't care. He didn't care. Yeah. This is not an ethnographic study of Italy. This is not a tour guide of Italy. All his Italian plays are just an excuse for people to behave horribly.
Exactly. He liked the words. He liked
so
the names.
Big, and he liked the names.
He liked the names.
Of course, Borraccio is a much better name. Petruchio is a cool, sexy name. It's better than George.
No one in the world named Dickens was great. Dickens' names are great. Austin's names are great.
But there were
greater namer of characters than that man in the world. I mean, Bottom. Bottom tells you everything you need to know about Bottom. And it's just because it's so fundamental.
But then there's Demetrius and Lysander. What a great name.
Interesting. Everything's in the name, I remember.
What's in a name? Everything.
Hermia, Helena, Lysander, and Demetrius. That tells you everything about the four lovers. You know, it's like,
Hermia,
I'm Lysander, you're Hermia, you're Helena, and you're Demetrius. And Demetrius is a fundamental, he was more fundamental. What's interesting, the great journey of the lovers, everyone goes on about Helena, but actually Demetrius is this very sort of staid, this is what I believe. He's the one who goes mental. That tells you everything you need to
and
know
of course,
about that character.
Doesn't
go
fall
back.
Out of the potion.
Exactly.
And
of that's
course,
what he's
still spellbound
exactly.
at the end. Demetrius.
And you
Demetrius.
Go, isn't that interesting?
He's one of the only men who was forced into marriage. Why?
Exactly.
In Shakespeare's plays. Because usually at the end it goes, oh, you've tried to evade marriage the entire play. Let me marry off to this duke and give you no more lines. So you can't protest it. And this poor woman...
But he's not saying I'm against arranged marriages.
No.
He's not saying that.
No.
He's saying, I'm going to start with that premise, but we'll see where we go. And it's all about the magic of love and all those kind of things. But again, there's no... The reason the dream has lasted forever and will last forever, there's a sort of, there's nothing impeded. There's nothing that impedes the way he wrote those plays. There's nothing that gets in the way of what of the poetry of the piece. Mm-hmm. And that's, I mean, you know, there's a great...
And there's rhyming. It's just, the dream stays with you, doesn't it?
It's never left me.
If you've done dream once, you pick it up again, you listen to it, and your body, your system remembers.
They stay with it like nothing else I've ever fucking done. These parts stay with you forever. Someone did say to me once, the closer you are to the essence of his genius, the more it never leaves you. And I think if you are lucky enough to play characters that just have more of him, that just have more of his poetry or his prose, they are the ones that never leave you.
Of course, Bottom is the one with the most lines in Midsummer Night's Dream.
He is.
Bottom is the biggest part.
He's the biggest part.
I've had a dream, passed away to man to say one dream. What a lovely part.
It's the greatest one. Ed was lovely about it. When he did it originally, he made Puck his focus. When we did it, he said, I got it wrong. It's not like he got it wrong. He said, I actually now think that Bottom is the focus and everything spins out from Bottom. That was just, again, it was the freest I've ever felt on stage. Mm. The freest. Mm. It was still...
I want to rewind, because we could do this all day. but you know, it's interesting that you said people want to know about him as a person. People are trying to find out what it is. But of course, that leads me to Shakespeare in Love. Because, of course, when I learned you'd been in Shakespeare in Love, my world shifted. I was like, what is happening? So you played George Bryan in Shakespeare
George
in Love,
Bryan.
Which, of course, sounds like such a modern name.
It does, but it's a real man.
George Bryan in Shakespeare in Love. Anyone who was initially a player, part of Lord Strange's Men, with Will Kemp and everyone else, and Augustine Phillips, and then moved to the Lord Chamberlain's Men. So it's a historical
fact.
Yesterday, I watched a film and just spied a young Bob Barry in the back of those incredible scenes, in the fight scenes.
I know.
And then at the end, with your fake beard. What were you playing in the Romeo and Juliet play?
I played two characters, but I also played Lady Montague. I can't remember the first character, but I remember playing Lady Montague. I had this huge dress, which... look, was hilarious. I remember Jim Carter phoning me up saying, you're famous. I said, why? And he said, there are three dresses. I went to Angels today for a costume fitting. There are three dresses in the window from Shakespeare in Love. There's Gwyneth's, the one she wears at the end. There's Judy Dench's as the Queen. And there's your fucking dress as Lady Montague.
Oh, that's fantastic.
But I got it. My agent put me up for it. And they said, no, we don't want to see it. And then she managed to persuade them to see me. And I went in, I sat with the director, who was amazing. He said, can you do Shakespeare? And I said, yes, I've done some Shakespeare. So I did a speech of Horatio, because I played Horatio. And he went, wow. I dried halfway through, and he went, okay, I'll take the book. So I had this complete Shakespeare, and I finished the speech, and he had a laugh, and he went, that was great. He said, I want you to be one of my Abel's men. And I said, that's great. He said, filming was for 6 months, I think. And we were on it as much as anybody. We were there for about 4 of the 6 months, every day on set, because he would go, right, I need Shakespeare, get Bob and whoever to come down, and we spoke Shakespeare. Most of it, almost all of it, isn't in the film, but it helped the atmosphere. In the end, he had to cut an hour off the movie, and all our stuff was cut. He rang us all up individually and said, look, I'm so sorry, but we've been previewing it in America, and they want the thing to be basically about Joe and Gwyneth with cameos. So a lot of it's going to be cut. I said, that's fine, because it wasn't about that. It was like a theatre job. We were all there, all the time. Everyone, there was no like, oh, you're the star and you're not the star. Mm. Everyone was just amazing actors. Yeah. We were just doing stuff, playing and getting to know each other. I saw Imelda recently and we were reminiscing about it, going...
Because, of course, Imelda is in it. We're watching this film, like, oh my gosh, everybody's in it.
I remember, because we were cast early, and I remember reading it, and I was ringing my mates up going, look, there's a part in it. It's not much, 2 or 3 scenes, but it's a really good part. Get your agent on it. And they'd ring back and go, Bob, for fuck's sake, stop ringing me about these parts. I said, why? And they said, because they phoned me back and they said it's already cast. And I was going, well, who's doing it? And they went, Anthony Scher, or Rupert Everett, or Martin Clunes, or Colin Firth, Ben Affleck. So I was going, okay, fucking ignore me. None of us knew what this was going to be. Yeah. The people they got were legendary Shakespeare actors, Judy Dench and Tom Wilkinson. But we were all just having fun with each other. There was no, do you know who I am? And you thought, the thing about the script is Tom Stoppard obviously wrote it. And there is a feeling that a lot of writers, certain writers, go, how the fuck can he deal with all this? How the fuck can one man go? So even though he's joking, Shakespeare is portrayed as someone who goes and gets ideas from Marlowe and gets ideas from here and gets on. And then none of his ideas, he's just gleaning little things. Mm-hmm. And he's a bit of a sort of, like a bit of a guy going, I can't write this and I can't write that. They can't accept there is this man who just sat and wrote this stuff unimpeded, and it's just miracles.
And of course they cast, you know, gorgeous Joseph Fiennes to be it, and it's all sexy, and the costume is sexy, and everything is like, rah, rah, and Shakespeare in love, and all of that. And, you know, he's boisterous, and then he gets in a fight with that fool. What is it, even is it about? We don't know. Who cares? We need a sword fight in this film. And then, you know, he just jumps in this boat, but in a sexy way. He doesn't just take the boat like a normal person. He jumps in it, and then there's a ball scene. And it's just all so, it's all so sexy. Oh, okay. The boat really did it for me. Of course, he's jumping on the boat, which nobody in their right mind would ever do. No writer I know is going to be on a shoreline and go, I will throw myself in this floating piece of wood and I will look cool doing it, and let me grab a torch for good measure.
Exactly.
It's just fantastic. Because of course, when I don't know, when I imagine Shakespeare, and we all have our own mental image, don't we?
Of course.
When I imagine him, I imagine, because what we know actually from him is very little, but we do know that he was a businessman, he was a shrewd businessman, who made loads of money from playwriting, which had never been done before. Very rarely since. Very good businessman, this man. And his contemporaries get into tavern brawls and get stabbed in the eye, or go to court, or go get thrown in prison, or displease the queen. They get into all this kind of stuff. And Shakespeare just potters along. No trouble with the law. When he appears in the law, it's always to do with his son-in-law, or with his neighbour, or with his tenants. He's not involved in any shady business.
Do you know so much more about
business?
This? I've never even read a book about him, because I just go for the place. But that's interesting. Even him being a businessman makes sense, because he just wanted the wherewithal to write. He wrote 30 fucking 6 plays. I mean, Jesus Christ. There's something you can't fathom about the man's genius in terms of just how much he wrote.
The amount. And of course, when you read it, you know, and there's a reason why we don't go about doing Pericles every year, or, you know.
Such a shame.
But listen, there's a reason why Midsummer's Dream and a Scottish play and Hamlet and Macbeth, because not all 37 plays were made equal.
No.
But that means it's human. That's what, for me, is an absolute proof that, you know, this guy had a learning curve. When you read them in chronological order, there is a progression, there's a difference, there's a change. And then you culminate with Winter's Tale, whose language is
The last four are. But again, you're right, he wrote Taming the Shrew, which I did, which I loved.
Because that's a very early one.
Very early one. And then, of course, he sort of returned to a similar theme in Much Ado About Nothing. It's a much more mature play. Again, you have Othello, and again, he returned to the idea of jealousy in Winter's Tale. And I mean, they're both the greatest plays ever written, but he thought, I'm going to have another stab at that theme and see where that takes me this time. And, you know, Othello, it took him here, and I think A Winter's Tale, I mean, took him somewhere completely other. The last scene in Winter's Tale, you can spend your entire life, people have spent their entire life trying to fathom what that's about, what these scenes are about, what he's talking about.
But just do it. Let the magic.
That's what that's the thing.
Let the magic happen.
And you have to do that. Ed said a brilliant thing about Shakespeare. He said, you start at the beginning. The hardest thing is Act 5. Because you start and you realise you're here and the play's here. Hopefully, you stick with the play as it's written, etc. And you come and everything makes sense in your production. And you then go, okay, that's fine. I've got to the end. If it goes, you're here, etc., the play's there and you're here, if it goes like that, then you're fucked.
Because by Act 5, nothing makes sense.
How many times do you watch production and you go, Act 5 is shit, it doesn't make any sense.
Because you're missing the point. You've added so many things. Your fear of embracing the text, you've added so many things.
You embellished too much.
You embellished too much. You said, let me put my genius on top of this.
Exactly.
And then you get to Act 5. And everyone's on stage, all these 16 characters, you know, 12th night, and you go, oh yes, and there's this backplot I forgot about. Of course Sebastian is still here. We haven't seen him in 3 acts. But of course he's here, and now I have to fit him in my stage somehow.
When we did Secret of the Best, I think of all we did, I loved every single one of them. But my favourite was 12th Night. And I remember Billington, I never read reviews, but Billington said, everyone has their perfect 12th nights in their head. But whilst we're waiting for that to be done, go and see this production because it comes closest to it than I've ever seen. And interestingly, we took Fabian out And I felt, when we came to Act 5, I remember Ed saying, I think this is the closest I've come. I remember watching him direct it, using everything he had, intellectually, emotionally, everything, just to get Act 5 right. And I think we got as close as, damn it, to where it should, for me, where it should be. So hard. So hard. But it's meant to be hard. You have to use every ounce of yourself. And everyone in the room has to use every ounce of themselves to get there. How marvellous is that? And when you get even close to it, you come off, and when we finished the tour, when we finished Twelfth Night, all these grown men sat in a room quietly for an hour. We just cried because it was over.
It's a very emotional. Do you think that's also part of the reason why we keep doing it? Is because it, you know, as artists, you're drawn to the art. For something quite intangible. The reason why you want to do this is to experience all of yourself and all of humanity and live something that transcends, that explains why we're alive, and to touch the mystery. Do you think there's something about that, that the demand in Shakespeare, the fact that it demands everything from you?
Yes, 100%. It calls on everything you have. And it's not just as an actor. It's as a person. It, you know, you think about it all the time. You use it as a guide. I remember doing Hamlet, and I'd sit backstage the whole show and listen to it. I was both times. I was Rosencrantz for it, and then I was two ratios. Had no desire to play Hamlet. I mean, we'll get to that a bit if we got time. We'll get to that a bit. I would listen to it, and I kind of knew it. By the end of it, I knew it pretty much. I remember going through it, and I knew almost all of it. And it would be a guide to your life. You'd think about your life, family, who you are, what you feel about life, and what you think about life. And when I read copiously, you read other people. But everything starts with Shakespeare. Everything reflects back and forwards to what he wrote. And I think whatever you read, whatever tale you read, whatever book, novel you read, they all reflect back to him. And yeah, because Hamlet was, I mean, think about these plays, and the idea that when you say all the plays that are done all the time, I mean, Hamlet, you sometimes feel they should put a kibosh on Hamlet being done for the next 5 to 10 years in this country, because it's done all the time. They get it wrong, because what they do, they go, oh, here's an actor who's established, very good actor, now's the time for him to play Hamlet. And you go, Hamlet's a part to cast like any other part. You have to get someone. I remember they asked Orson Welles again why he'd never played Hamlet. He said, I can't play Hamlet, I'm not right for it. The thing about Hamlet is you have to cast somebody who, when they walk in the room, without speaking a word, can change the intellectual temperature of the room. Because that gives you an in to how you're going to play this man of genius. And I thought, that's true. And I was thinking, that's you. Well, if you fucking don't think you can play it, then what's the point in bloody playing? So, and also, you have to not just get someone who can play Hamlet. You need to get, your first call should be to a Claudius and say, I want you desperately to do it. Because great actors tend to shy away from Claudius. And their first question is usually, well, who's playing Hamlet? And you go, I haven't cast Hamlet yet. I want you to do it. I want Gertrude to do it. I want the Polonius to do it. And you have to cast that
the whole play
brilliantly. If you don't, you're not going to get the right play.
And of course, there's so many versions. A lot of it is also about how you cut it, which one do you use? And all of that, it's complex dramaturgically before anyone's set foot in the rehearsal room. It's so many decisions are made about what this Hamlet's going to be like based on the version of the text and the cuts you're going to do.
And that's the thing.
If you do them.
If you do them.
If you don't, that also tells you about something about what that production's going to be like.
Exactly. It's the greatest play, one of the great works of art, if not the greatest work of art in literature, because there's nothing it doesn't encompass. He wrote men of genius and men of greatness up until Hamlet, you know, Henry V. You know, Mercutio. After Hamlet, he wrote flawed men. His great protagonists were flawed. Othello, King Lear, Coriolanus, Leontes, Prospero. They're all flawed men. And it's almost like he came to a point with Hamlet where he thought, okay, now I'm going to start writing a different type of play. Hamlet is the great moment in that sense. If you start cutting it, it's interesting what cuts people make. Because you miss stuff. I'd love to see a 5-hour version.
And it's fascinating, is it? Because the Elizabethans lived much closer to this idea.
They didn't go, she's 5 hours long, I'll get home. They fucking loved it.
Yeah, they loved it. This is the only thing they had to do. It was exactly. That bare beating bit.
But also they had the imagination to be able to sit through it. Because most likely, when you look at a speech of Shakespeare, often you have a 12-line speech. 10 of the lines will have everything, and the last 2 lines sums up what the speech is about. So therefore, it was just going, don't worry. Don't worry, I might go somewhere and you might go, what the fuck is he talking about? But I will always come back to the last year. They knew that when they came to the plays. They'd go, oh, I get what that speech is about. So he can go somewhere extraordinary. And the last couplet will be like, that's what it's about. That's remarkable. He had the foresight to do that. I mean, my mate Simon Usher wrote a book, great act, great director, wrote a little pamphlet called On Directing. And it's best-selling pamphlet in the National Theatre's history. He wrote snippets of thoughts, and one of them was paraphrasing what he said. When he did Tyrone of Athens, and he said, an actor asks his director, we need to talk about the money because it doesn't make any sense. At some point I say this about the money and there's another thing about the money and none of it makes any sense. We need to know in modern parlance what the money's about. The director says to the actor, all right, we'll get to that later, but in the meantime, think about this line, the moon is an arrant thief. Which sums up everything to me. The minute when Hugh Courcy went and played Othello, he came back and he was like, this Shakespeare that you talk about. And I said, what? He went, the narrative doesn't make sense. And I was going, of course, he's a poet. He's a fucking poet. The narrative doesn't make fucking sense. Does life make sense? Do you go out there and think, today makes complete fucking sense?
That is so brilliant. Because of course it doesn't make sense.
No.
But we are so obsessed putting everything in a box. Everyone wants their labels. And our world has become so alien to what actually makes sense to humans. And then, of course, and then it triggers 2 very different reactions to Shakespeare, which is either, oh my gosh, this nonsense makes perfect sense to me. Let me embrace that with open arms. Or, no, can't deal with any more nonsense. Is this statue alive? And is it a statue?
Yes.
And she wake up and, I can't deal with that. I will flee this place of paganism and never come back.
Have you ever been in love?
Yeah.
Do you think that makes sense? Yeah. Do you think that makes linear fucking narrative sense when you fall in love with somebody?
It brings us back to what you were talking about at the beginning. There's very little space between those feelings and the poetry in there. And
you have to let it affect
breathe
you.
With it and let it affect you.
Yeah.
Reverberate in your body.
100%.
And then the beautiful thing is you've seen it done incredibly well.
Yeah.
And you've done it incredibly well.
Well, I've tried.
But then you also see it and go, this is not happening for me, either as an audience or as an actor. Like, you're sat there going, okay, I'm leaving at the interval, this is not working, I'm not going to do this to myself. It's interesting to think about, why doesn't it sometimes work?
If you impose too much on it, if you don't listen, you've got to listen to the play, really, listen like you've never listened before in your life. Really, really, really listen to what the play is. Not what the play is trying to tell you, because he's not trying to tell you anything. He's not saying, these are the secrets of what the play's about. You just have to listen to the play and be humble, but confident enough to put everything into it to make it come alive. And I think that's incredibly hard. But it's also incredibly easy. If you distrust the play, in any way to go, right, I'm going to impose this on it, make it about this, set it here, make it about something modern, and I'm going to cut this and that because it doesn't make any sense to me. Even though it's about fairies, I'm not going to engage with that at all. The minute you start saying no to it, blocking what the play is trying to tell you, then you're on the wrong curve. And I think it does, unfortunately, it takes a director of great nerve, great enterprise, great imagination, and great ability to unlock. You cannot question it. You're faced with a man who doesn't have foibles, doesn't have agendas. He's just writing from his gut and soul. Mm. And he's a genius. So you're going to have a helping hand there. Just find a simple way of just trying to get to your own soul, to your own centre of your being, and just see where that takes you. Will you succeed? Who fucking knows? Who cares? But if you cut yourself loose, you give yourself a fighting chance to get where that play's taking you. And if you're all doing it together, and that's the other thing, you know, Shakespeare had an ensemble.
Of course.
And so if you're all doing it together, you can help each other.
The final question would be, two final questions, would be why do you think we should keep doing it? Every generation's done it, but now there's this debate, shouldn't we do new writing, things that haven't been written by an old white man who was a man of his time, you know, and it was a time that we have now learned from as a society, but he was a man of his time, and you can't separate that completely.
Yeah.
But it's a debate. Why should we keep doing it?
My obtuse answer to that question is, if you are a society which is inching away from a writer like Shakespeare, then the problem is the society, not the writer. If anything lasts in this world, it's the literature, the music. That's what we learn from when we think back in life. The fundamentals about how we live our life. If you're burning books, ignoring the great lessons from the great minds and writers of the past, you're making a mistake. If people are saying, well, he's an old white writer, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what he was and who he was and when he wrote. What we have and what's lasted for 600 years are these plays. Are you going to fall in love in your life? Are you going to be jealous in your life? Are you going to be angry about society in your life? Are you going to be
in grief?
Hungry? Are you going to have times in your life when everything's going wonderfully and you question that? All those, everything to do with being a human being is in those plays. If you're not going to have those things, great, find someone else. I don't think it's a question of we stop doing Shakespeare and do new plays. I think everyone should do new plays, always. I think we do too much Shakespeare. It should be something we approach with a little bit more humility and a bit more sort of craft than just going, oh, we must do another play, we must do a Shakespeare, we must do a Shakespeare, we must do another Shakespeare.
And there's that sense of responsibility. When you do a Shakespeare, you also have to approach it with a sense of enormous responsibility, because some people in that audience, it will be the first time they've been dragged to see a Shakespeare.
Yes.
And if you do it soullessly, they will never come back.
They'll hate you for your life and they'll go.
They will never come back.
Yeah.
The theatre world will have lost them forever. It will take a miracle to get them back.
Yeah.
Studies have been made, in the RSC Education has done this wonderful survey where they said, actually, as a child, a teenager, when they get Shakespeare, when they feel like they got Shakespeare, it empowers the rest of their school life. Because they think, oh my God, if I can get Shakespeare, then I can do anything.
I can do anything.
Because it's supposedly
the hardest thing in the world, impenetrable.
But actually it's funny and it's cool and I like it and there's no problem. And you can change lives.
You can change your life.
Look forward to editing this. Oh my God, I have to... We could do this for like 3 more hours.
We could.
I have to ask you the final question, but also before that, Bob, during this hour and a half that we very kindly, graciously spent together, I had several moments where I've realised, oh wow, this is so important. This moment is something I will remember for a long time.
Well, so will I. So
thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It's been amazing.
So much.
Incredible.
I can't wait to
very emotional.
Get into it and edit it. And it's just so brilliant. So brilliant. And then the final question is, who do you think I should speak to next about this?
You know so much about it. And I want you to direct Shakespeare. I want you to be doing Shakespeare, because if there is anybody who would come to it in the right way, it's you. So therefore, I think that should happen. I would, if I was you, and I'm sure she'd do it, I would ask Lucy.
Yes.
I think Lucy Bailey is probably the one person you should ask, is because she's had an experience of being at the coalface of doing it.
Thank you so much, Bob. Oh my God, so much editing work ahead of me.
So much editing work.
I'm
Now I'm terrified I'm going to press the wrong button.
Well, don't do that. I'll do it all again.